Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the water to my well, it's Dan. Got a light, Dan?
Unfortunately, I do not. Which does not bode well for me.
I got one here. Here's a light for you. Think how much simpler things would have been for the woodsman if he only had a zippo on. Just knocked over my mouse, so I don't know if I came across on the podcast. You guys still there? Dan?
I'm not going anywhere.
Okay. I'm here. I'm sorry, Mike. As an eerie omen to the podcast, like everything in my house just went black for like a minute there. It's like, oh God, what happened? Now I expect flashing lights to happen all around me. Anyway, with that bizarre opening, it's only appropriate that we are here tonight. Oh boy. Probably to talk about one of the most bizarre television experiences I know I've ever had. I'm guessing probably the same goes for you, Dan, right? It works out perfectly that we are done with Better Call Saul and Fargo. Uh-huh. Because this was an episode that I don't think I should be squeezed in with any other show. It needed its own podcast.
Yeah, the week before, I had been behind on the show, and so I did another two episodes, and then, you know, me and my friend were going to watch it last Sunday, and we're just like, oh, you know, only one tonight, that kind of sucks. And then, like, halfway in, I'm like, there's no way I could fucking handle two episodes tonight. I mean, oof.
Yeah, I have to hand it to Showtime. I mean, I know it's a pay cable service, so they can be a lot more flexible and lenient, or whatever you want to call it, with their content. But can you imagine when they first were shown this episode? And, you know, again, this, it's got to be the most different piece of television that I've seen at pretty much ever. You know, as far as I mean, maybe at some point in time I'll think of something else. You know, but all those things I can think of are brief. They're like music video length or something like that. Not a full, pretty much a full hour of television the way this was. So it's unfortunate we couldn't get talking about it earlier this week. But I wasn't able to watch it for a few days, so this is the first time we've had time to talk about it. So. And I've kept my reactions to it online pretty much to me saying, because the first thought I had after watching it, well, maybe not the first thought, let's say the fourth thought I had after watching it, like, yeah, that's going to be an interesting one to try to figure out how to podcast about. But the good thing about having so much time since I've seen it is it's marinated in my brain like, you know, like a pickled egg or one of those eggs that we see floating in an ejaculative stream later in the episode, actually. So this would not have been, I don't know, it would have been a funny podcast, but it wouldn't have been can you imagine if we had tried to do one of our Instacasts and like talking about this one, like, you know, minutes after we watched it? It would have been like dead air. I think my head would have felt like the guy, the DJ at that radio station, quite frankly. I think that's what David Lynch did to me with this episode. Okay, so with our I don't know if that was a preamble or what that was, but I think we should probably dive into what we've been talking about. And of course, what we've been talking about is Twin Peaks. One good thing about this episode, which is already the wrong way to phrase it, there's a lot of good things about this episode, but the one good thing for us as podcasters, at least it starts off in a way where it's easy to start talking about it. It's just like, oh, it's that kind of an episode. And then about 10 minutes later, we realize, no, it's not. One thing that's kind of been interesting that I've become more aware of just watching the show this season, and it's only because I kind of maybe I'd forgotten because I haven't watched a lot of David Lynch stuff in the last few or several years. You know how different directors definitely have their own specific, I don't really want to use the word trope, and that's just because one of our fellow podcasters overuses that word as far as I'm concerned, but you know what I mean? There's just, I think of it more as a signature. Like signatures, yeah. Different directors have, you know.
Yeah, there's, you know, tons of people like that. Just like if you see, like, you know, like a Wes Anderson shot or something, you're just like, yep, that's Wes Anderson.
Right.
David Lynch definitely has a couple of different things where they're just like nobody else is going to do. I mean, David Lynch has like a lot of things that nobody else is going to do.
Yeah. True. But exactly, it's, you know, it's either be a kind of shot or just a kind of imagery that you'll see run throughout their work. You know, you can look at like Stanley Kubrick, and there are certain images or shots that you will see in both Paths of Glory all the way to The Shining and Full Metal Jacket. Or the way someone looks up and looks at the camera, you see the similarity from, you know, Clockwork Orange to The Shining to Full Metal Jacket. You'll see that same kind of shot, and you're like, oh, that's a Kubrick thing. And you can go on and on, like Wes Anderson, like a Scorsese, whatever, everyone. I noticed that one of the things that Lynch does, and is I don't think anyone else does the driving by night shot quite the way Lynch does. And it's interesting because there's nothing that's like that, like, breathtaking about the way the shot is composed. It's literally just, you know, shot from the perspective of a driver and just the lights on the road. And it seems on one hand, okay, we've seen that shot a million times, but somehow when Lynch does it, there's just something just slightly more off and eerie about it. And I know this goes all the way back to his work in the 90s. I mean, obviously Lost Highway, which, you know, there you go. But it's been a repeated thing throughout this season. And heck, they even use it in the ads for the show for this season. So I always think it's kind of, it always has that weird foreboding of evil. That you, like, okay, you know that if someone's driving and you've seen that shot, they're probably not just going to get to their destination. Everything's going to be hunky-dory. Something's going to go wrong. Probably someone's going to die. Whether that exactly happened here or not, well, let's talk about that now. So we open with the whole thing with, what do we call, have we ever come up with a specific nickname for this version of Cooper? Because I know if you read every single review or any other podcast, they all call him different things. It's Evil Cooper, Dark Cooper, Doppel Cooper, you know, like, have we ever, we don't seem to stick to any one, right? Maybe,
no.
We don't care.
I think I end up calling him the doppelganger more than anything else, but, oh, you know, that can change.
Well, let's, for consistency, we can just call him the doppelganger Cooper. Well, that's really long. I'm going to call him Doppel. Someone used this phrase earlier. I'm going to use Doppel Cooper just because it's silly. So we've got Doppel Cooper writing with, the guy's name is Ray, right?
Yeah.
So this is fresh out when they've done their little, can't really call it a prison break since they were pretty much allowed to leave, but whatever. And apparently there's some sort of information Ray has that Doppel Cooper wants. It's numbers that he's memorized of some sort or something like that. And Ray is realizing that, you know, it could be worth a lot of money, so maybe he's going to hold on to that information until he gets paid and so on. And right off the bat, I'm already thinking, yeah, this already sounds like a really bad plan, guy. Now, I'll admit right now that I almost had a moment of confusion, and again, this is just the way I've interpreted the Doppelcooper character for the first 7 episodes of the season. I always felt like he had some, I don't know, maybe not an overall use of ESP, but I thought he could sort of read people's minds up to a certain point, which now I'm looking back and it doesn't make any sense, because then he'd know that people were thinking there was something off about him. But I just, for some reason, I thought that was his way of intuiting knowledge, that it didn't make sense that he would know otherwise. But I'm realizing that theory is stupid, even as I'm saying it out loud right now. You know, I was trying to figure out, how else would he know about the Warden and the whole thing with Mr. Strawberry, whatever that was all about. But maybe it's because he's just in tune to bad things that have happened, and then he's kind of like the CNN of bad news in his brain or something. I don't know.
I got the impression that he got information about the prison because he kind of like hacked into it with like, you know, FBI computer or something before he got arrested. And you know, one of the earlier episodes of the season. So I'm assuming when he did that, then he got like information about the, you know, like what he could use to blackmail Warden Bill Buchanan. I can't think of anything else to call him.
was that a 24 o'clock? Because he was Bill Buchanan. Yep. 24. Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah, I guess that's, you know, definitely that's a possibility. It's also one of those things where it's hard to imagine that the Warden would have blackmailable information that could be accessed that easily. But who the heck knows? The one thing with the show, and I gotta tell you, if I was a writer on the show, I would have been fired because I would be like, what? Anyway, but I like the idea that they don't. I'm gonna curse now. They don't give a flying fuck about trying to explain things to us because they don't need to. And I'm not even talking about the crazy supernatural metaphysical stuff. I'm talking about just whatever technology they happen to have, because quite often it's like, okay, whatever, we'll just go with that. I mean, the way that Cooper, or Doppelcooper, I guess, is able to find out that they've got tracking devices on the car, and what he does, it doesn't make any sense. I don't know. I mean, is he James Bond who has this app on his iPhone which can find the trackers, and then he just punches in the license plate of another car, and that's it. And then he just tosses it away. I was like, I wish all problems in screenwriting could be resolved so easily. Like, how are we going to get out of this one? I know. Just come up with an app. And you're like, boop, boop, boop.
I like to imagine the people that, you know, still can't get over how Lost ended and how they didn't get answers for, like, pointless shit. Like, I'm just imagining, like, I really hope they're watching this show because they're just, it's not going to end well for them, so.
I would say that anyone who was hung up on whether they got answers or not from a show like a Lost, when watching an episode like this, they would probably look something like one of the Nazis at the end of Raiders of Lost Ark. Because I think they would just melt right there. And their eyes would just fall out of their head or something, because it's like, yeah, good luck. Although I haven't heard it yet, but I know Damon Lindelof is a massive Twin Peaks fan and David Lynch fan. I would love to hear his reaction to this episode. Because I know I heard that podcast that he appeared on where he was talking about an earlier episode this season. And that was a great podcast, by the way. Thanks to whoever posted that, and I got to listen to that. But I would love to hear what Lindelof has to say about this. I mean, I'm sure he loved it, but I would just love to hear someone, you know, with that kind of creative mind and a writer himself, what he made of this. So let's dive back in, because we haven't even started to touch on the crazy stuff yet, you know, but we're about to. Let's just get to the point that, you know, what is it? Ray stops for a leak, and we think, oh, well, obviously Doppelcooper's got the drop on him. He's got the gun and everything. But it turns out Ray's a little smarter than that, and it reverses, and he kills him, or seems to kill him. He shoots him. Now, I'll say right off the bat, if he thought he was going to be getting money from Doppelcooper, it seems odd that he would therefore kill him. But then again, if Doppelcooper needed the information, it seems odd that he would kill him. Who cares? Again, I don't care. Because what happens next is the first of the wait, what? So, Doppel Cooper apparently falls to his, falls down, drops dead there, shot, whatever. And then these things appear. And at first it seems like they're apparitions of some kind because, are they solid or not? It seems like at some points you can see through them or not. I understand that they're generally referred to as the woodsmen, right? Is that how we should refer to them, I'm guessing?
I don't know. That's how people on the internet are referring to them, but that doesn't really have any basis in anything. So, that's what people are calling it, but there's no, it's not canonical.
I'm going to go with it because I don't really have anything else to call them. Yeah. They could be coal miners or chimney sweeps for all I care. they look like that. But it seems like that has been the phrase used about them and about one specific member of that tribe that we'll be talking a lot about later on. So let's just dive into theory speculation time right now. These creatures, and we were hinted at them in a previous episode because we saw one walking down the corridor in the prison in the previous episode, right? Wasn't that, because you mentioned it at the end of the podcast.
I'm assuming that's one of those. That one kind of, it's hard to say because we saw these in the dark and that was, more lit up. So it's possibly the same thing, but it definitely had the same kind of general appearance.
I'm pretty sure it was because even though it was more well lit, they still kind of shot it in where it was virtually a silhouette where you couldn't really make out much in the way of detail other than the fact it looked like it was coal black from head to toe. So I think that was already hinting. In the previous episode, which I would say is probably considered the most easily digestible episode, the most quote-unquote normal episode that we had gotten of the series so far this season. I like that there's a little hint you think so? Here's a little sneak preview of something for the next one. So what do you think these creatures are exactly? Because I know there's probably at least a few different theories as to what they are or represent. And I think I have my own idea, but you're a hardcore Twin Peaks fan. You're someone who's actually watched Fire Walk with me several times, and so, which will come in handy, I'm sure. Maybe not so much in this episode, but certainly during the course of the season. What did you take those creatures to be? As far as the overall canon,
just based on what they did to the doppelganger and just how they just kind of shredded them there, I just kind of got the impression that they're kind of like the Black Lodge version of the Langoliers from the Stephen King novella, if that makes sense, where they're just kind of he was supposed to spend his 25 years doing whatever, and then now they're just kind of harvesting what. The really shitty stuff he was doing while he was out there.
Mm-hmm. I like the Langoliers reference, even though I hate that story. I think that's in a similar vein to what I was thinking. I mean, number one, definitely they are definitely they are connected to the Black Lodge. I mean, that almost goes without saying, as far as I'm concerned. I like the idea of that they're kind of these minions that are essentially harvesting, because what happens while they're patting the earth around him, and I think at certain points the body kind of disappear at one point and then reappear. It seemed it was very the way Lynch shot this, and I think the problem for most TV viewers. I think he shot it on such a high definition thing that it was harder to see on your more conventional HD TVs. So it was really shrouded in darkness, really hard to make some certain things out. But it looked like he kind of, that Doppel Cooper kind of appeared and disappeared at certain points. Or was I crazy? I kind of thought that happened.
Yeah, I didn't notice that, but there was so much going on. I mean, it definitely could have happened and I just would have missed it. I was just more focused on just how I was just the blood gushing out of him in various ways, and it was a little, almost felt kind of similar to what we saw earlier in the during the first couple episodes when that couple that was banging got shredded by that thing that ended up in the box. So right. I'm wondering if that, like, you know, maybe, like, you know, one of those spirits got captured in the box and then just, you know, shredded him like that.
I don't think they were so much shredding him as they were smearing him. They were taking the blood from his wounds and, like, basically smearing it all over him. So the way it came off to me, it was more like they were performing a ritual. Because, you know, they're all, you know, some of them are still, like, you know, almost doing, like, a tribal dance around him while others are, you know, massaging his body and smearing the blood all over his face and whatever. And getting to the phrase that you use about harvesting, because one of the things we see Bob. And
yeah,
I got confused, and maybe it's bad that I only watched the episode once, but I felt it was so burned in my brain, plus I have limited access to be able to watch it, that I can remember it well enough for this podcast. But was the impression that people had that was them extracting Bob from him? Because I'm confused by the notion of that because of what happens shortly thereafter. Because you know what I mean? So I'm a little bit unclear about that. But it certainly felt that's like what happened. Like they had extracted Bob from this creature. That doesn't mean that Doppelkooper isn't still like some evil entity, but maybe he doesn't have the Bobness in him anymore. That's kind of the way it seemed to me.
He could just be like an evil Dougie now.
An evil Dougie, oh God. So that was something special. And shortly after the woodsmen do their dance and Ray takes off, and I like that he's freaked out when he's watching it, you know, of course. But he's not quite as freaked out talking about it in the car to... is he calling someone named Phil? Are we supposed to think, I mean, this is, and again, for folks who haven't seen Fire Walk With Me or don't remember it, kind of like, then those guys and gals fall into my category. I think there's been an assumption they've made references to Philip or Philip Jeffries, and that's the David Bowie character from Fire Walk With Me. Is that who we're supposed to think he might be calling, or is that just guesswork on our part?
I'm assuming so, because it's the only Philip from this universe, and the Cooper doppelganger, you know, talk to Philip Jeffries like, you know, some, you know, disembodied spirit of him or something using some weird device in an earlier episode this season.
Right.
So, you know, but as to like why Ray would be talking to him is, I mean, that's information we don't have yet.
Right.
He was an FBI agent that disappeared, like, working on this kind of stuff in Argentina. And we've seen that, like, the Cooper doppelganger was, like, you know, in Argentina, because we saw a picture of him wearing, like, an awesome, like, you know, Miami Vice shirt or something. So,
right.
So, but I'm, you know, possibly, you know, I'm guessing we'll get more information about what's going on with that, but maybe we won't.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing with this show, more so than anything else we've ever or will ever watch, is, be prepared that any number of things may never be explained, because that's always been kind of the blessing and the curse of Twin Peaks, even, you know, 25, 26 years ago, is you never know how many things we're seeing actually mean anything or actually are just in there just for quirky effect or fun. And they have admitted that, I believe, because there's some things like, no, don't split this time focusing on that, because it actually doesn't mean anything. But then something that's even far more esoteric could turn out to be, like, really important or something. But if I recall, Ray says something along the lines of that, he essentially says, I think I killed him, but I'm not 100% sure, because looks like he got some help, which I guess he's talking about the woodsmen doing what they did, which is like, that's putting it mildly, a very nice way to put it. But he said something like, something about the key. Like, there's something that Cooper has, which is the key to all this, or had as a key to all this. I don't know if he's referring to the fact of seeing, like, the Bob being extracted from him or not, if Ray's brain could even process that or not, I don't know. Again, these are things that aren't super clear, but compared to what follows, that is, you know, it's pretty much, it's like Cliff Notes for Dummies as far as I'm concerned. Before Doppelkooper rises from his supposed death, we do have a brief segue back to the Roadhouse, where instead of ending an episode with a musical number, we get it about several minutes into the episode, and it's the Nine Inch Nails. I'm just to be clear, I've always been a fan of Nine Inch Nails and Trent Reznor. I think they're a really perfect marriage with David Lynch. I know that Reznor and Nine Inch Nails basically produced the soundtrack for Lost Highway about 20-odd years ago. And their kind of music, which is, you know, kind of a merging of like industrial and goth and metal and, you know, all that kind of weirdness and their themes. I can't think of another act which is, you know, of that magnitude, which is really aligns itself really this well with the David Lynch sensibility. So it is pretty funny that they would just show up in the episode, be introduced in that way. And then they're singing a song, which quite frankly sounds like, I do not know if that song was written for this specifically, or maybe it's a song after a new album, I don't know. But it sounds like it could have been written specifically for this episode, or for Twin Peaks in general. It certainly had a lot of Twin Peaks-sounding themes running through it.
Definitely a very unsettling performance, too. I mean, you know, none of them seem like somebody I'd want to, like, meet in an alley, you know, watching them play.
Oh, yeah. Which is funny for me, I kept thinking, this is one of the more subdued Nine Inch Nails performances I've ever seen. But it worked in the context of this episode. And as their song finishes up with the, you still hear the echoes of the music, that's when you see Doppel Cooper kind of open his eyes, and he's still got those big, overly black eyes going, so you know that he's still evil. But we know he's back. And that's kind of like where normalcy, as far as Twin Peaks or anything, ends. And then we get the rest of the episode. Now, I gotta say that before I saw the episode, I wouldn't say I was genuinely spoiled on it. I knew that there was a lot of reactions to it online. And, you know, kind of like, what the hell did we just see kind of reactions. Like, oh, cool. Like that. I kept thinking, it would be like that episode we watched, you know, a few weeks ago with Cooper in the box and all that other stuff. Before he becomes the Dougie Cooper and whatever.
Yeah, so, same here. I'm just like, you know, the reactions I was seeing, I'm just like, oh, we're going to see like another, you know, midget stabbing or like another kid getting like, you know, smoked by a truck or something, but definitely not.
It wasn't that. And the closest I was to having anything like genuinely spoiled, and I wouldn't even really call it that I was. I saw someone's Facebook status, someone I know, basically said Twin Peaks just did their version of the final reel of 2001: A Space Odyssey. So in my mind, I was expecting there to be something like the what happens in 2001 when David Bowman essentially, for all intents and purposes, enters the monolith, so to speak, and that crazy light. I was expecting something like that somewhere, and we got that, but so much more. I'm not upset that I knew that little bit because it didn't really spoil much of anything. I just knew that I was expecting a crazy light show. Is basically what I was expecting.
Yeah. Well, I suspect that they spent a lot of money on special effects this week, because there was lots and lots of stuff they were doing.
Yeah, they. Well, let's get right to it. We go back in time, and I don't recall. And you'd have to correct me. I don't remember. I don't know if we've ever had a flashback sequence in Twin Peaks before. I don't think so, but I could be totally wrong about that. Maybe, and I'm not. Maybe in the movie they did. I don't know, but I'm talking about as far as the TV show is concerned.
Yeah, I think the only one I can think of offhand is one where like Ben Horn's talking about like, you know, some girl dancing with a flashlight, and like when him and Jerry are young. I remember.
Okay, but so basically, we've never flashed back about, you know, 70-something years. So if I'm remembering correctly, we're going back to 1945 in New Mexico, and what looks like the testing of, you know, detonating the atomic bomb.
Yeah, at the Trinity site.
Now, And they've kind of hinted at stuff with, you know, atomic bomb explosions and whatever. I know there's that gigantic picture behind in Gordon's office at the FBI with the big mushroom cloud, which, by the way, is a very strange image to have in your office, you know, if you're working for any part of the government, especially the FBI, but okay. So maybe, and I guess that could have been like a hint of what was going to be coming in this episode. So, yeah, and it was interesting because I was trying to figure out initially if it was being shot in black and white or it was a certain type of thing because there seemed to be some element of color into it. But I just kind of stared at it because it's a very slow progression towards the eventual explosion and then the mushroom cloud. And then we eventually enter the mushroom cloud, which is kind of where I think things... If things weren't crazy just already, that's where things get... I think that's where the 2001 stuff... so, or at least certain parts of that come into play. That was dizzying, and I it was funny, because I was eating lunch while watching this, and I had to put down what I was eating and just push it to the side and just rewind a minute back. And I said, let me just absorb myself into this and really see if I can really make heads or tails of the images that are happening. Because these are all these different types of effects, practical effects. A lot of them are basically camera and photographic effects. You know, either everything from scratching the film in different ways, whatever. And also trying to interpret what some of these images are. Because some of them are actual things, I think. I don't know how else to phrase it. But, it goes on for quite some time. This is not like 30 seconds. Like I didn't count how many minutes it went on for, but it went on for a while, but I found it dazzling. I was just like, wow, I can't believe this is happening. And
yeah.
So when this was happening, when you were watching it, what was your take on this? I mean, how was your brain handling this, and were you watching it at the right hour?
Yeah. I definitely was, you know, it was very hypnotic. And then it was interesting too, watching my friend that I was watching it with me. He's kind of going through like various stages of trying to, like, you know, get off opiate type stuff. So he was going through a bit of a detox, and, you know, plenty of ups and downs with that kind of crap. But him watching this, I mean, it just totally fucked his shit up. I mean, his body did not react well to what was going on during this scene, because it was I can't even imagine what he was going through. Ugh.
Yeah, I'm also trying to imagine watching this episode and specifically certain sequences like that one while under the influence of anything, be it drug or alcohol.
Yeah, because it was jarring and, you know, unsettling enough just watching it, like, you know, completely stone cold sober like me and, you know, Ted Nugent, straight edge type people. So,
So now again, only having watched it the one time several days ago, so if my memory is faulty, I apologize. So we're going through this experience of going through the mushroom cloud, and whether it be that a lot of the imagery is there's a lot of black and white usage and what's flashing and scratching across the camera. Now. I'm going to have to rely on you to kind of like make sure I get events in the right order here. I didn't mention it earlier. This is a rare podcast that I'm doing with virtually no notes whatsoever. I've written down an actor's name, and that's all I've written as far as this episode is concerned. Because I feel like it burned not just on my retinas, on my brain so much. I just want to talk about it without writing anything ahead of time. I just want to just see what comes out of me. And speaking of what comes out of me or comes out of me. So is it during this sequence? I'm trying to remember the order of things right now. Is it during this sequence that we see that figure floating, which I gather is actually referred to as the experiment? Or do we get the convenience store thing happen first? I forget the order. Do you remember?
Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember.
Okay, so let me get the experiment thing is, I think they're both probably have their levels of importance, but I think the experiment thing is maybe a touch more because of what happens. Because that's, I think that's the, if I'm sitting there wondering what the hell is going on. And then when this entity is floating there, it's this female, somewhat female-looking figure that I believe we've seen before. It might have been in the New York, sequence earlier in the season. I can't remember right now. But I feel like we've seen it before. But then it, I don't know how to phrase it. I don't know if you want to say it vomits out, it breathes out, it ejaculates out. I don't know what the right word is. You know, a torrent, you know, flows out of it. And if you're watching closely, and I kept pausing occasionally to make sure I didn't miss something, because you see in this, you know, protoplasmic, whatever you want to call this, stuff that's flowing out of it, there are all these objects floating within it. And they look like they're spores, or really like eggs. I think that's, which really makes a lot of sense considering what we see that happens later in the episode, of course. But one of them we see very specifically and very clearly. This is one of the few things that was really clear in the episode. We see Bob. And it was at that moment, I think finally the thinking part of my brain started to function again, just a little bit at least. And I realized, okay, I think I'm seeing what may be like, quote unquote, the birth of Bob here. Now, yeah. Is that how you interpret this whole thing with the atomic explosion and everything else that happens in this whole segment? Is this simply the birth of Bob? Is it more than that? Is it more about the beginning of the Black Lodge itself, or about evil, or is it just a Bob thing? How did you interpret it?
Well, I've read the book. Okay. So I kind of have a little bit more information about this, but it seems from what I've read in the book, it definitely seems like the Black Lodge stuff was around a lot longer before 1945. So I'm just guessing this is kind of like when Bob was created, and then like somehow, like, you know, the Black Lodge can kind of, you know, end up connected to some of these darker spirits.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible maybe by setting off that bomb that maybe that opens a doorway to it or something, and that's what helps to create Bob, maybe? I'm just trying to figure out if the Black Lodge had any influence or did things previous to this or not, or was this maybe the moment that kind of like set things in motion as far as that was concerned. Which in a weird way, I guess because it was the dawn of man being able to use, like, the most horrific weapon possible. And, you know, when you've created a device which basically is made to kill millions of people, I mean, even if it's used, quote-unquote, you know, for the right thing, like what some people say the U.S. did with Japan, although it still resulted in so much death and whatever, but it's still seen as, like, big bad bomb that kills millions? That's about as evil as you get if you really think about it. So maybe just by setting that off is what inspired or spawned the whole thing for Bob. I mean, why else would it happen at that point is the way I would look at it.
Yeah, definitely seemed to spawn Bob and, you know, maybe have some kind of, you know, what these other, you know, woodsmen, whatever spirits, you know, what causes them to materialize to. It's, you know, whether or not they were created then, or they just kind of like were able to like cross through between realities there.
Yeah. So let's go to the thing where I was unsure about the order. And I know this is something that I assume you have some information about from other previous sources, be it the movie or the books, whatever. That convenience store, where we see the woodsman kind of, you know, sped up, you know, almost like a time lapse kind of a thing, where they're milling about and going in and out of that convenience store. Now, I know I've heard something where that's kind of a significant thing for the Black Lodge, or there's something like on the floor above the convenience store. Do you know what I'm talking about, or can you fill in that blank a little bit so I don't sound so scattered right now?
Yeah, in the original series, that's kind of like where Bob and Mike like lived. They lived above the convenience store. I never got the impression that they lived above like a convenience store that was in, like, you know, New Mexico, for example. But they never really said one way or the other. Whenever it was talked about, it was just, you know, Mike in some kind of a weird trance, just talking about, you know, why he cut his arm off. I wish I would stop saying, you know, every 5 seconds, because when I listen to our podcast, I'm like, what the fuck are you doing, douchebag? Why do you keep saying you know? But that's what I do.
Yeah, it could be worse.
Yeah, barely.
And this convenience store, when I was looking at it, again, it's that part where it's being shot, and it appears to be shot in black and white, much like the actual atomic bomb explosion that we saw previous to it, although we do get some color a little bit later on. But and of course, then we end up, I think most of the episode is actually shot in black and white at this point. But I was trying to figure out if the convenience store was supposed to be a location that was actually near the test site of the bomb, or even if it wasn't a genuine convenience store, or one of those like little fake things they built, you know, to see how would it be if we set off a bomb, there's a town nearby kind of a thing. Since it was still intact, I assumed it wasn't that, it was just an actual thing. I don't know if they actually called things convenience stores in 1945 and had it out there, but I don't care. I don't get hung up. You know, it's like getting hung up on the cost of a burger in 1979. Yeah, I made a joke. inside joke for our podcast. Anyway, so I was trying to figure that out, but I didn't spend too much more time on that because there was too much more craziness to come. So, I think in between the 1945 and the 1956 parts, we get that other part. Now, if I felt like if David Lynch was channeling, other than his own auteur vision, which, you know, is always kind of obvious and tremendous, but if he was also kind of like, you know, making a nod to other things, you know, there's a certain, you know, either be a certain Kubrick quality with what happens through the mushroom cloud or whatever. He went back in time to, like, you know, he goes back into like the era of Fritz Lang, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh yeah, because it's definitely
a very huge silent movie feel to a lot of the sequence that's upcoming. So in between those 2 years, I think we see that thing where we see those purple waves, right? Which, I assume, you know, this purple water, didn't Cooper look out of that box he was in, you know, at one point, and he saw kind of a similar thing like this, you know, a vast, endless purple ocean? I seem to recall that from...
Yeah, that seemed familiar, that and some of the, like, the Starfield stuff we saw, too.
Yes. So, we end up at this structure, I don't know... Quite. I mean, I know what I think it's supposed to be, and I'm guessing that you're probably going to agree with me on this one.
Yep.
But, you know, just what it looks like before defining what it is, you know, it looks like this, you know, at first I was like, oh, is it going to be a lighthouse? And it's like, no, that's too elaborate to be a lighthouse. It's more like a castle or a fortress or something. I don't know what it is. But once we got inside and we see this woman sitting there, who I understand she's referred to in the credits as Senorita Dido. Which is good because I was just going to call her, you know, silent movie diva or something like that. And she's in this room. There's something playing on the gramophone, which has a bizarre antiquated quality to it. And I think I heard somewhere that might have been a piece of music that David Lynch co-wrote himself, which seems just about right. There's also a structure in this otherwise very gothic looking room, which kind of sort of looks like the same kind of design, I don't want to call it architecture because it says some structure, as it reminded me of what was on top of that box in the episode with Agent Cooper was still Agent Cooper. You know what I'm talking about? Where it has that quality where it looks like the metal's been kind of hammered out to have curves in it, whatever. It looks like a giant bell of some kind or something, or I don't know what. I don't think we're supposed to know exactly what it is, but, you know, I think it's open to interpretation. But I think my mind started working in when we see. Should we just call him the giant? I don't know what else to call him since the credits have him with all the question marks, which is so ridiculous. When I saw that, and I started thinking. And I was already thinking from before about the Bob stuff and that being connected to the Black Lodge. Is this the White Lodge? Because that's kind of what I'm thinking it must be, because they've made references to there being a White Lodge. Is that what this is? Because that's what I think
Yeah.
It was white on the outside, like, right?
Yeah, more or less. I suppose it's probably what it's supposed to be. As to whether or not we'll see any more of that location, who knows?
I kind of hope we do. I mean, maybe not for several episodes, but I certainly hope we go there again. So in this sequence, I mean, I guess that weird bell thing, that like some alarm goes off and then it's turned off, whatever. Maybe that was, and maybe it's at that point in time the giant's been alerted to what's happened on Earth or something, or New Mexico, perhaps. Because that's when he goes into that room, which basically looks like a movie theater. And we get to watch what we just saw all over again. I mean, you know what? Let's just be happy that David Lynch didn't do what I wouldn't have been shocked for him to do if he literally would have played the entire sequence all over again, which would have been like, okay, that's insane. But he certainly plays a significant amount of it. So the way I'm looking at this, the giant is watching what has happened, and he's seeing what's taking place. So he basically sees what I guess we're calling the creation of Bob, right? So yeah. Is it now, and if that's Bob, and that's also the doings at the Black Lodge, which then that's why I'm going, this is like the counterpoint if it's the White Lodge, and then what happens next? So how did you interpret what happens next, if you want to talk about that?
I got the impression of what was happening like as it started, but after, I mean, what, I don't know. It's just, the cat set me off my game.
Okay,
but it definitely, yeah.
Well, he's floating, and then in a slightly more aesthetically pleasing way compared to the entity, the experiment, whatever that we saw, you know, spewing and then Bob coming out of it, as well as God knows what else. Apparently weird insect-like things that we'll get into. What comes out of the giant is something kind of pretty about it. It's got this very golden color. And remember, everything we've seen in the segment, other than the purple water outside, has been black and white, so it certainly stands out. But we see these little, I don't know what you call them, spheres or globes or bubbles or whatever. Hey, and one of them is Laura Palmer. Now, and I think it doesn't at one point like float down to Senorita Dido, who then like, you know, lets it, releases it, whatever.
Yeah.
And is that in the, now is it the sphere with Laura Palmer we see like basically enter the movie screen, and now it's suddenly, it's like a, for, I don't know how else to phrase it, like a cartoon version of the United States now?
Yeah.
As opposed to like, you know, an actual photograph, and it apparently heads right for, I guess, the Pacific Northwest, I'm assuming. So I know what I thought when I first saw that, and then I thought about it some more, and then I kind of dismissed my original interpretation because it didn't make sense to me, which, of course, if I'm worried about things making sense, it's Twin Peaks. What's wrong with me? I didn't think it was specifically the creation of Laura Palmer. I thought it was like the idea of Laura Palmer and maybe what the chain of events that she would be part of would help enable. Does that make any, I don't know if I'm making sense here.
Yeah, that makes more sense than anything else, because I mean, we were seeing, I mean, you know, when Bob was created, we just saw Bob. But when with Laura Palmer, if, you know, if they show her prom picture, I mean, it's like, you know, hey, you're just gonna show like the prom picture that they show like in the credits of Twin Peaks. That's a lot different than showing like the actual person themselves. So what you're saying, where like maybe they are just kind of like, you know, setting in motion a chain of events, is more of an accurate guess as to what's going on,
right?
There.
Especially because, I mean, if I mean, although one kind of almost wonders, outside of the events taking place on, you know, in New Mexico, if what's happening in the White Lodge, if it kind of feels like it would be outside time and space anyway. So, or maybe it's kind of like the it's first season True Detective time. Maybe it's time is a flat circle. So maybe it's both 1946 and 2016 in the White Lodge. I have no idea. Or 1992 for that matter, or something. Or 1990, right? I can't remember when Twin Peaks was.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, but yeah, I just felt like it was more a catalyst, if that's the right word, I think. You know, because they see that, you know, the Black Lodge has put this into motion, which is going to result in this, you know, horrifically evil creature being, you know, the epitome of evil, quite frankly. So maybe by, you know, starting this chain of events with the Laura Palmer thing and setting that in motion, even if years ago, because for all I know, it could be this is what makes, you know, Leland Palmer meet his wife and leads to the later on the birth of Laura Palmer. Who knows? I mean, again, it's beyond open to interpretation as far as I'm concerned. I think it's almost fun that we can come up with a billion different theories for it. But that's the only one that kind of that seems to make sense as kind of like the counterpoint. It didn't make sense for it to purely be her, because unlike Bob, who, since he's, you know, a supernatural creature, it doesn't matter what year he comes into existence. But Laura Palmer, at least her time on Earth, I didn't get the impression I don't feel there was anything that supernatural about Laura Palmer until she died and went into the Black Lodge or something, as far as I know.
Right. And if they were trying to like create like a good, you know, like a good counterpart to Bob, I mean, Laura Palmer wasn't that. It wasn't the way it ended up shaking out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why it did make sense. She's not the epitome of good. I mean, I remember the show, and I remember the Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, which I had, and I must have lost it in one of my moves. Really upset that I don't have that book anymore now. But that's why it just makes more sense that she's more representative of the chain of events which they thought they would be able to use to counter Bob, even if it didn't ultimately work out that way.
Yeah, I can see how somebody would think that while watching the episode. I mean, there was a lot going on and, you know, not really much time to think about this stuff. But I think after giving it some thought, it definitely, you know, your theory is pretty solid.
So then we fast forward, which I certainly didn't do during this episode. then we skip over to 1956, and we're still in New Mexico, right? Is it the same area? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what happened? Oh, this is the egg, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we spend a lot of time watching an egg hatch in the middle of the desert, and one can assume that based on what we saw in that floating goo coming out of the experiment earlier in the episode, that one of those weird, you know, horrific Easter eggs, this is one of them. And something comes out of it, and it looks like it's kind of some sort of mutated form of a, you know, it looks like it's part frog and part cockroach or fly, or it's pretty hideous, you know? And one of the things I kind of enjoyed about seeing that, at least this part of the episode, we'll get to the other part later, the fact that, you know, Lynch has been touching on things like, you know, like the Kubrick style with 2001, and then the silent film era, you know, whatever. And now, with this 1956 segment, and, you know, again, we're remaining in black and white, and then this mutated creature popping out, on the which is basically the site of an atomic bomb test, he's going right for those 1950s monster movies where every other creature was born out of like the atomic age and due to an atomic bomb being blown up, whatever. You know, I mean, obviously the most famous one is Godzilla, but Christ, there must have been, I don't know how many movies there were like that during the 1950s that were, none of them which were as good as Godzilla, quite frankly, but there are a lot of them. So when I saw this creature coming out of it, and I was like, oh, Lynch is getting into 50s monster movies now. Okay. And I think shortly after that is when we see, I mean, I'm going to forget the order of how we see certain things, but essentially we start to see, do we just see the one woodsman or do we see several? I forget at this point. We see several.
Yeah,
we see several. Yeah, I just remember because what happens on the road, I forgot about that. Okay.
Right.
So those woodsmen that we are again are assuming are the minions from the Black Lodge or whatever, and maybe the birth of this creature is what, you know, summons them. Perhaps because those two,
yeah,
these two events do feel like they must be connected. So now I have no idea what that creature, if it quote unquote represents anything or what that will lead to. I don't know. I guess it's towards the end of the episode, so maybe I'll wait till we get to that. I'm feeling a little sick just thinking about it right now, quite frankly. So we get those apparition like woodsmen again, you know, and they're up to all sorts of, you know, stalking towards town and whatever. But we get one that speaks. Finally. Hopefully my impression wasn't too horrible at the beginning of this episode. I don't know if I've got the throat to even attempt it again. You know, the whole, you know, the character who keeps saying, "Got a light," to everyone who walks by. The only note I took about this woodsman and this character, I was curious, because I'd heard a little bit about this actor. Because this, eventually, after all the whatever goes on the road and the menacing this couple who luckily for them actually get away, but he eventually makes his way to a radio station, right? And, you know, well, crushes the head of one woman and then goes into the DJ booth and I love that he's doing this with the cigarette in his mouth the entire time, by the way. he's like the bass player in Huey Lewis in the News. Wow, I just dated myself with that cigarette just dangling from his mouth the whole time. So while he's slowly but surely crushing the head of the guy in the DJ booth, he proceeds to take over the airwaves. You know, he removes that record. And what he says is what I said at the beginning of the podcast. I don't know if I should repeat it again. I'll repeat it in normal voice now. Or maybe I should do it in the other voice. Anyway, he goes, "This is the water, and this is the well. Drink full and descend. The horse is the white of the eyes and dark within." Now, the way he says it, it made me really curious about this actor. And because I was listening to the cadence of his voice and how he was delivering the lines, and the first thing I thought of right off the top was, "Oh, his voice." I mean, although I think it's been tweaked a little bit in the, with sound, it's been modulated a bit there, but still, it reminded me a lot of the voice that Daniel Day-Lewis does in "There Will Be Blood" as the character Daniel Plainview.
Yeah.
Now watch all this. Now the interesting thing about that is when Daniel Day-Lewis did Daniel Plainview, and I heard that voice, I remember thinking, "Oh, Daniel Day-Lewis is really doing a John Huston-like voice here," which because it has that kind of similar cadence. If you ever listen to John Huston when he's acted or spoken, he had a way of speaking. Which, watch Chinatown, you'll know what I'm talking about. But the funny thing about this, but the actor who's playing this. The head, or the evil, the most evil of the woodsmen, what he's best known for having done before is playing Lincoln. Because he's got, even if you look at him without the makeup and everything, he's got kind of a Lincoln-y look to him. You know, he even has that kind of similar facial hair, but his face is like that. And of course, Daniel Day-Lewis, as we all know, his last role was playing Lincoln. So I kept noticing like all these little weird connections started happening in my mind while I was watching it, which have nothing really to do with Twin Peaks, but I just was enjoying that. Someone I know, a listener of ours and a friend of mine, hey, you know what? Since someone mocked me for whether I mentioned people's names or not on the podcast, I will mention his name. So Mike Cullen, I know you're listening. So I know he had posted on his Facebook page earlier this week. I don't remember where the article came from. One of those websites, whatever. But it was really cool because it was showing how so many different shots and locations that were in this episode look like they were modeled to whatever extent after a number of Edward Hopper paintings. Which, knowing David Lynch, makes perfect sense for so many reasons. You know, the fact that Lynch is an artist himself and a painter or whatever, and Hopper, the era of Hopper's paintings really does make sense for a lot of what we see in this episode. But a lot of sequences we see. I mean, track it down online if you guys want to. I mean, I don't know, put in Edward Hopper and Twin Peaks and you'll probably find the article that way. So, because we bounce around town and we see these different shots of, like, you know, the waitress in the diner, the guy working on the car, and then there's that couple, your classic, you know, oh, they're so cute 50s couple or something. And they all have that, you know, that, you know, that pure 50s feel to them, whatever. So when the woodsman is speaking, did you think that people were just falling asleep, or did you at first think that they were dying?
I thought they were falling asleep, but it could be interpreted either way, I think.
I'll confess, when it was first happening, I thought they were dying. I didn't change my mind on that until what happens with the girl, because she is clearly sleeping. So I realized, okay, they're all just falling asleep. Okay. So talking about that girl. So she's on this date with this, you know, nice kid. I don't know if that girl is supposed to be anybody or not. Do you think that girl is supposed to be anybody, or is she just a random girl in the 1950s?
God, I just don't know. Maybe she's somebody, maybe not. I'm not sure who she would be way back in 1956.
Right. Because obviously, I mean, as anyone listening to this podcast knows what happened, she, listening to the recording, not the recording, the guy saying, no, this is the water, and this is the well, and then everything else. I just like saying it, sorry. The creature makes its way from the desert, the little frog, cockroach, fly, thing, whatever the heck it is, which was a nice, easy way to refer to that creature, makes its way up to her room and proceeds. This is probably the only moment in the entire episode that really bothered me. I mean, obviously in a good way. I mean, it's like a horror movie, just finding something just so disturbing. It's like you almost want to look away, but you can't. Unlike the crushing of the heads, which was pretty extreme, especially what happens to the DJ, where it's just like the blood is like water. The water. Anyway, sorry. But the fact, what creeps me out almost as much as what that bug does, is that her mouth just opens up for it. It's almost like a psychic command that happened, like a garage opening. Her mouth just opens up for it, and then it proceeds to... get in her. I don't know. I can't figure out how to phrase it right now. I'm at a loss for words. So that's what I was trying to figure out. Okay, now this creature, you know, much like, you know, like Bob, whatever, I'm assuming is yet some other, you know, like, piece of just pure evil, you know, or whatever, and that it's going to be infesting. What's the word I'm looking for? That's not the word I'm looking for. Word, it's from all the Alien movies. It's what do you call it? Why am I? This is why I should have written notes. Whatever. It's entered her body. That's why. And so thus you wonder, is she somebody? Gestating. Thank you. Is she anybody that would lead to somebody else? You know, and I've heard some speculation, but none of it makes any sense because of the time period. So. Right. You know, because if this is 1956 already, so I know there was speculation, oh, maybe she's, you know, so-and-so's mother. But I don't think it works too well time-wise. Like, I remember, I thought I read one place, oh, maybe she's Leland Palmer's mother. I was like, does that work? I don't think so, because that would make Leland Palmer way younger than he could possibly be. So that doesn't work for it. So...
I don't know, he could be 45 or so in 1990, 91. If Laura's 18 or 19,
well,
I guess, you know.
This is 1956, so 1990 would be 34 years later.
So, oh, that's 34,
There's no way Leland Palmer is in his early to mid-30s, and she, you know, it just doesn't work. And again, this might be one of those, maybe we'll never know. And it's just something creepy, because this is where we get it. It's a very art house now. Because we went from 1950s horror movies or monster movies, and now this is something like something that would be some weird, you know, movie that would be lampooned on Sprockets back in the day on Saturday Night Live, just this weird, you know, almost abstract German kind of thing where I'm just staring at the screen like, really? I'm going to watch this creature, you know, crawl into her mouth? So I mean, I love that they did that. I love the idea of pitching that in that Showtime room to the executive. So you know what happens now? Then this creature just, you know, just basically goes right into her mouth and it's like, wait, what? And that's also the closing image of the entire episode. The credits roll over her sleeping. And I kept waiting to see if something would happen, even though I knew nothing was going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
But you couldn't help watching and wondering. Did we forget it? I feel like we might have forgotten something significant. Anything I left out?
I don't really think so. I think we got it covered pretty good.
So basically, I think the takeaway is that, you know, the 1945 stuff, you know, the beginning of Bob, what happens in the White Lodge, setting things in motion to try to counteract that. Now, that works fine. Now, what happens in 56, I'm not so sure about, because they're kind of like, wow, this seems beyond Bob right now. This is just, I don't know what. So I'm still kind of at a bit of a loss on how to really make enough sense out of what we saw. Whether that plays a part in this show and what happens from this point on. For all I know, maybe we just got an origin story for all these different things, and that's it. And we're not really going to go back to any of this.
Yeah.
I wonder. I mean, it feels like we're going to see. I mean. But clearly the woodsmen are still prowling about now, so I'm wondering if we'll see the speaking one, you know, drink full, Anderson. I mean, I feel like there's a certain Muppet. I feel like I sound like Rolf right now or something. But you know what? I don't mind that I'm not sure what I saw and that what that all means, and why this happened. I know that they appeared because this creature was born. And I think what they did in the whole operation of going to the radio station and doing that to basically put everyone, which we're interpreting, puts everyone to sleep, and why not kill a few people while you're at it too, I guess, whatever, was maybe also kind of laying the groundwork for that bug to find that girl and crawl inside her, because she was under in the trance or the sleep, the deep sleep from hearing the magic words. So I feel that that's the connection between all of that stuff. Because once that happens, I think, you know, then they all kind of disappear off into the night. So it's just trying to figure out what is the significance of that creature entering that girl and if it means anything. Because if it's not Bob, then what is it? And it's not Bob. I don't think it has nothing. I don't think this is Bob anymore. It's something else entirely. Is it just another evil that we haven't really spoken about on the show? Is it that weird evolution of the tree thing, which, quite frankly, I think is not exactly the epitome of good. Squeeze his hand off, you know. This will be one I look forward to at some point in the future watching again and trying to, maybe after a few more episodes have passed, see if anything makes more sense about it. But
yeah, totally.
I'm glad that we had the opportunity to see something that my brain still hurts from. You know, it's like I said, it's like the woodsman crushed my head as well trying to watch that. But wow. It was, you know what, no matter what happens for the rest of this series, and great timing for them to take, you know, a week off, by the way, because just let that one sit with people for a while. Again, even if we end up with like seven more freaking episodes with Dougie, or, you know, a half an hour of someone, you know, using a dustpan somewhere or something, I don't know. But the fact that this bringing back Twin Peaks yielded an episode like this, which is about as avant-garde as it gets. I mean, you know, bravo to Showtime and David Lynch for doing this. Even if most people watching were like, I don't know what I just saw. It's like, you know what? That's what made it something special. Because you don't know what you just saw until you started thinking about it. Then maybe you could put some things together. But who cares if you can't figure out everything? Because, you know, we're not that smart.
Yeah. No, yeah, definitely. Good job for Showtime letting the guys do this. This episode definitely kind of has the feeling of, like, this is like a Mark Frost story, and then just letting Lynch just go full Lynch. So it's like full Frost, full Lynch, and it worked really nicely.
Yeah, I mean, I just, again, I keep thinking back to the episode that we thought was the crazy one. And, you know, it wasn't normal. And then how positively light and, oh, that was nothing. Oh, big deal. Oh, so there was no dialogue for about 10, 15 minutes that we could hear. Okay, that's fine. This? What the? But even being able to interpret things, it's still, I can interpret things and still be like, yeah, but what the fuck was that? Oh, but I enjoyed it tremendously. I'm so glad. I'm glad we got to do a podcast about it. And hopefully there was some nuggets or floating speckled eggs in our podcast here that people enjoyed as well.
Yeah.
And that, if that isn't a segue, I don't know what is. If you did enjoy this podcast, you will probably enjoy our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. You can find the page that way, like the page, and join the conversation about mindbenders like Twin Peaks, as well as more normal shows like Fargo and Legion. You can also find us on iTunes as the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Subscribe to our feed. And you can rate and review us there. It would be nice to get some more ratings and reviews there. Unless they're bad ones, then please don't. And finally, you can find us on the Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. It's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. At the very least, we should be back in a week or two for the next Twin Peaks episode. As long as I have access to them, I want to keep podcasting about this craziness.
Good, yeah.
Whether we're going to podcast about anything else, I have no idea, because I know time is at a premium for both of us, and it is the summer. I'll tell you right now, I wouldn't mind at some point later this summer doing at least a half-season worth podcast on Preacher, because those first two episodes, that's what we wanted the show to be all last season. So it was Preacher launched this past Sunday, and that's what I wanted last season. It's crazy, bonkers fun. Not crazy the way Twin Peaks is crazy.
Huh.
It's a different kind of a crazy. It's more like a, wee, I'm on a roller coaster, as opposed to Twin Peaks, wee, I just open a door and I've fallen into an abyss and I don't know what happened. So.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet, but it definitely sounds like people are digging it. So I was thinking that maybe we can grab Kate in a week or two or three and, you know, talk about it some, just for something to talk about. Maybe before Game of Thrones starts, we can talk about the first few or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking too. You know, something like
sweet.
When we have time. It's, I think either we did it all in one podcast last time or we cut it in two. I don't remember. But I think the way the storyline is going on that show, it's a very nice, solid, it's a quest. And I always, you know, I love you know, storytelling that, because it's clear to understand what's going on. It's a quest. I love a quest, and it's a big quest. Anyway, let me wrap it up here because I know we're going a little long. But actually, not that considering what this episode was, it wasn't so.
Huh, yeah.
So I will say good night to you, Dan. I'm tempted to do the voice again, but I won't. Looking forward to talking about the next one at some point in the near future.
All right, sounds good. Good night, Scott.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Roadhouse is proud to welcome the 9-inch Nails.